Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a podcast about computer programming and technology, recorded in New York City. I'm Jim Wallace.
And I'm Ben Gunderson.
And today we have a very special guest from Two Ton Studios, an indie game development studio out in Seattle, Stephen Danton.
Hey guys, thanks a lot for having me on.
Absolutely. Hey, so you just released your first iOS development as an indie game developer. It's called Ninja Boy.
That's right.
Yeah, Jim was just showing it to me. I love the UX of it. I love the controls and everything. I actually have an Android myself, so I haven't really gotten to play it really thoroughly, but I was really impressed by the art as well.
Yeah, the art is good. The controls are smooth, and the graphics look great, and I think you did a great job. Why program video games? Like, why do that?
Yeah, video games are interesting. I mean, I have a lot of experience building what I would consider productivity software or tools, a lot of people would call it. Mm-hmm. Games are just kind of a totally different experience. It's really a way to meld together a bunch of different things to really entertain people. So, you know, the kind of things you balance in productivity software, things like efficiency, workflow, you're trying to get optimal kind of task management, so on and so forth. You don't really worry about those things as much in a game. A game's a lot more about immersion, pacing, trying to evoke a particular emotional response from people, trying to provide a good balance between challenge and fun. The biggest thing, you know, I've learned along with working with my brother, it's the two of us that really do Two Ton Studios, is really how important that balance of kind of visuals and gameplay and sound effects and music and all these things are to creating an experience that that actually resonates with players, much more so than productivity software.
I see.
You know, kind of a case in point really is when you start playing a game, right, when you show a game to people, mm-hmm. You know, they really, all those things have to be in place for them to kind of even start understanding what the game is going to be. Whereas productivity software, you can kind of show an early demo, even wireframe sketches, and a lot of people can be like, yeah, I can understand how that tool would work. And so really being able to challenge ourselves and do the kind of, you exercise other parts of our minds is kind of why we do game programming, why we're into game programming.
So of all the challenges that you just listed, which one was the one that drew you the most to wanting to do games? Is it the programming challenge? Is it the UX challenge of having immersive experiences, et cetera?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a little bit of all of those things, but I think really being able to create these entertainment spaces for people is really the main challenge and the main thing that draws me and my brother to the experience. Of course, we also grew up playing a lot of games, like
sure.
A lot of people do, and so being able to kind of replicate the feeling that we had as children and still do today is something that's got a pretty strong allure to it.
A lot of people got into programming in the first place because they played video games when they were younger and wanted to make games. Is that true for you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I had a kind of an interesting road to getting into programming. I went to school initially. I was going to try and become a lawyer. So I was studying political science and psychology. And then I decided, you know, that wasn't really for me in about my third year of university. And I decided to switch over to computer science, really because, you know, I wanted to kind of figure out the magic behind video games. And until you understand how to program, video games and really all software does kind of feel very magical, but definitely video games I think feel more magical than, you know, a tool like Word or something. And so that was really the thing that drew me, is how do I figure that kind of thing out? How do I make that happen?
Yeah, I think that those are great points. And Ben, I definitely got into computer programming myself because I played video games once upon a time and wanted to know how they worked.
I wanted to make a game. That's why I
Yeah, and then I discovered how hard it is to make video games and that you can actually get the same money for way cheaper. and so I do envy you, Stephen, that you've gone through with it.
Games really do represent like the ultimate challenge at pretty much every level of programming.
Yeah, especially the optimizations,
like the purest form.
Really to the metal, squeezing out performance out of the hardware. Did you run into those challenges?
Oh, absolutely. Performance was it's interesting when you go and build a game. Really, it's kind of you get it done, and then you spend all this time, you know, really, really squeezing as much perf as you can out of the thing, mm-hmm. Really working through playtesting and stuff like that. We spend a lot of time optimizing performance, and in we used a technology called Unity as kind of the backing engine for the game. And so that gives you a head start, definitely. But there's enough intricacies where you're really trying to reduce the number of draw calls you have. Ninja Boy, although it looks 2D, is actually a 3D game, so reducing the triangle count, building things called texture atlases and stuff like that to optimize the amount of texture space you use and things like that. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time trying to really wring as much perf out of the game as possible. I was just listening to Carmack's
keynote 2012,
keynote, and man, that takes performance to a whole new level. But you know, yeah, I mean, we definitely have to spend a ton of time on perf. We found actually getting consistent frame rates, you know, locking a frame rate at say 30 frames per second is better than having, you know, the ability to have 60 frames per second, but then sometimes having cases where you drop to 30, that really creates a very immersive, immersion-breaking experience. So.
Oh, I think Carmack was saying that too in his yeah. Because he's trying to push games to 120 hertz.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And he says that basically the technology that we have now for graphics, it doesn't really matter. You can show people a high-res polygon next to a low-res polygon, and they can't really tell, or sometimes worse, they choose the wrong one to say which one looks better.
Yeah. Right, right.
And so we've got it when it comes to graphics as far as gameplay ability goes.
Is there a limit to how much that actually, you know, improves user experience? I know
there's diminishing returns for sure.
And Peter Jackson is actually getting a lot of flack for pushing his movies up to what, 48 frames per second.
48 frames, yeah, absolutely. Right. On our own stuff, like there's you know, when you're testing a game like Ninja Boy on the different iOS you know, devices, there's a really interesting experience you go through. Whereas you look at, like, we went back to the old 3GS was kind of the least powerful device that we you know, supported.
Okay,
and you just look at the resolution and the frame rates and stuff like that, and it's definitely good. It plays well on that device. But then you go up to like an iPad 3 or an iPhone 4S, and it's just so incredibly smooth and so incredibly sharp that you know, it really does create this stronger sense of kind of immersion and quality, and especially with a kind of a puzzle platformer like Ninja Boy, where you're going to die a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That ability to have kind of that rock solid robustness in terms of you know, you believe that the game is really bulletproof, and then it's up to you, the player, to overcome the challenges of the game. That's such an important balance to maintain, or else the player starts really getting frustrated and starts to feel that the game is really out to beat them, rather than it's a challenge that they, you know, they can strive to overcome. So,
how many other people were involved in the testing of the game?
I did a lot of the testing on my own. I also did, you know, testing with friends. I had two friends that came in and helped out late in the process. One guy did a lot of work with sound effects and also did a lot of testing. My wife actually is probably the uber game tester and has a very good sense of she kind of reminds me of an art director in a sense of she can look at something and say, you know, no, this should go here, no, that should go there, or that, you know, you're investing too much in this detail or not enough in that, and really helps, you know, keep me kind of on a straight and narrow, gives me a lot of great feedback for testing. So, yeah.
Did anything really surprise you during the testing process, like something that kind of blindsided you? You were like, I mean, it's really easy as the developer to focus on something in particular and kind of lose focus in,
or to think that something's intuitive that's actually not.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if we had any of those huge aha moments. I know we spent I probably played each level in Ninja Boy easily, you know, 200 times. And so it's the thing that's most surprising is how much time it takes to kind of get, and I don't know if we've gotten it perfect, but we tried our best to get that challenge curve to be right in terms of, you know, right. You play with one of our friends who's never used a phone before, doesn't know how tilt controls work at all, and you know, they got like spaghetti arm, like their hands all over the place, their whole body is into the experience. It's like an amazing thing to watch. And then you see a guy who's like, you know, played Doodle Jump, you know, for 3 months, and for them it's like nothing. They totally get it, they know how it works, they understand kind of how the gyroscope works and stuff. And so getting that balance to be really right was more challenging than we thought.
I understand that. I love that visual of the spaghetti arms all over the place. It reminds me of when I used to watch people play Super Mario Brothers 3, and every time they would hit A to jump, they would also move the controller up. Jump with the controller. I always thought that was, and I'm like, oh, well, Nintendo must have seen that and created the Wiimote.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Yeah, totally.
You can play the game completely one-handed, right? You could give someone two phones, one in each hand, and see. You know,
yeah, exactly.
For extra challenge.
Dexterity test, yeah.
Sure. Right. Why did you choose Unity as opposed to going with something like Coco Touch 2D or along those lines? Why 3D for a 2D game?
Yeah, so we've I did a couple things. Like initially, I wrote the game on Windows Phone, and so it was all written in C# using the XDA framework. And then we tried to port it using MonoTouch and MonoGame. Mm-hmm. And MonoGame is an excellent technology, but it was a little bit early when I tried to initially port it. So it still had some problems, like it had some memory leaks and stuff in it that I think they've fixed. But at any rate, we had this code base in C#, and we were kind of looking for a way to, you know, to move it over. We're also fairly big fans of some of the work that I don't know if their name is Mika Mobile or Mika Mobile, but they did Battleheart and Zombieville USA and things like that. And they basically did 2D games using Unity. And so we kind of saw like an opportunity there to take some of our C# knowledge and put it in, you know, kind of this new tool. It turned out I ended up rewriting the entire game, so that other than knowing the syntax, I didn't get a ton of benefit of using C#. But the other thing was, if we ever wanted to go and build real 3D games, Unity is a 3D engine. It's a lot easier to grok than, you know, and a lot cheaper, to be honest, than trying to grab, you know, one of the more higher-end engines. So we felt if we kind of could learn that tool, learn that ecosystem, learn that workflow, that might pay dividends down the road. So
no, great. It makes sense.
Without, you know, going too much into your finances, how has this turned out financially for you at the 99-cent price point?
I'm probably earning like fractions of a dollar per hour at this rate. We've sold we have about 400 downloads right now. So we've done you guys are probably our first, you know, public marketing gig, I would say. We've done very little marketing. We are engaging with I'm partnering with a woman who specializes in social marketing. You know, she's going to become a partner in Tuton, and so we'll see how that works. Maybe when people look at Ninja Boy, they think that it's going to be kind of a kung fu hack and slash beat 'em up, even the name and maybe some of the graphics. I don't know. We really wanted to build it much more as kind of the movement, stealth, avoiding kind of combat, much more child and kid friendly. Right. Much more, we call it kind of authentically mobile, trying to make a game that you really couldn't play on a non-smartphone.
That's what I really loved about it. I loved that you couldn't do this on anything else, really. It's a, you know, it really requires that gyroscope, you know.
Yeah, gyroscope device, motion. Right. Really good job with the control.
You can play it completely one-handed, right? It's just like, you know, tap with your thumb or...
Cool, thanks a lot. Yeah, we tried to, like, subtle things, too. Like, we did a portrait mode instead of, like, most platformer kind of games are landscape, right? Because that's how they are in your Xbox or whatever. Right. But we wanted to do portrait because very few, if any, you know, classic Xbox PC games are done in portrait. We didn't want to have any on-screen controls because, you know, you can probably do that better on a gamepad or with a keyboard or whatever. And so it's been hard to get that message out to people. It's also unclear if people really, you know, want that as an experience. If it's unclear to me really what is successful. I know the games that are successful on iPhone, but I don't know what the secret sauce is to be successful on the iPhone or an Android or whatever. I mean, we currently have 190,000 unique plays of the Windows Phone version, and an average rating of 8.7 out of 10. So, you know, that's based on 5,000 reviews. So there's a large number of people out there using Windows devices that truly love the game, and you know, our goal was really to match those numbers on the iPhone.
Right.
We thought that was realistic, given that the iPhone was an order of magnitude, if not more, users than the Windows Phone.
But also an order of magnitude more apps.
More competition. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're going to see, you know, how much can marketing help? Is it just a matter of getting the word out?
Right.
Is it really, you know, people really do prefer more of the kind of lay in bed, you know, or on the couch playing an Angry Birds type game? Are those the games that really ultimately do well? Or do you have to be kind of like building an Infinity Blade and really at the highest end of kind of 3D and stuff like that to stand out? You know, we'll see, I guess. Our goal is to be in the top 100, you know, on the American App Store, and you know, we'll give it a while to get there. So we're definitely not there.
I can't imagine someone, you know, seeing the game or seeing how it works and not wanting to pay 99 cents for it. I mean, do you think you nailed the price point? Do you think would charge more for your next game?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. That's something we talked a lot about. So I've talked to some friends that do iPhone and iPad things, and they say that actually a better price for our game would be $2.99 or free with in-app purchases. So either of those models. Right. We went with the 99-cent route, kind of for the same rationale that you're just saying. Like, we wanted people to see it. They don't know us. We don't have like a brand or following from the studio, and say, hey, this looks cool. It's got some decent ratings. I'll try it. It's only 99 cents.
So you're, I don't know if that's a reputation play.
Yeah, exactly right. And try and get people to know about us, get people to enjoy the game with pretty low barrier to entry. and see if that works or not. We may find out. The guys who did Fruit Ninja, they did a game called Jetpack Joyride, and they initially had it as a premium game, they call it, like a paid game. I don't know what the price was, 99 cents or $1.99. And they found very quickly that they couldn't stay within the top 200, you know, games in the States or wherever they were trying to, you know, keep in the App Store. And so they switched to a free model with in-app purchases, and now are hovering around 80, you know, rank of 80. And it's just interesting that I think what you have to do is kind of be willing to try out a bunch of different things and see really what sticks. There just is so much volume and so much competition that it's hard to predict, I guess.
Yeah, speaking of the competition, John Carmack also addressed this in his keynote this year. He talked about how frighteningly quickly it went from basically all indies to big game studios now. I mean, it was like three years or something before the iPhone became a game studio. Although for them, mobile development has stopped because it wasn't as profitable. He says that most people are not making $30 million. Maybe the Fruit Ninjas of the world are.
Yeah, you really, it seems like you really have to hit the jackpot. But you can do it with a much smaller team as well, so the risk is much lower.
Indeed.
Exactly, yeah. And in theory, you know, we spent 8 months working on Ninja Boy, and a lot of that time was spent kind of figuring out how to get a 2D game to work in Unity, familiarizing ourselves with the technology and the different, you know, the art pipeline and stuff like that. But in theory, you can also build them a lot faster, right? So less people, you know, probably 6 months of development time. So, you know, if we got going at a pretty good clip, we could kind of get four or five titles out there in the next couple of years and then really understand know what the market is doing and maybe know what works and what doesn't work.
I am curious about what – it's not like mobile gaming is a new thing. It is new for smartphones to have games on your phone that are so immersive. But
I miss Snake.
Yeah.
But the Nintendo DS has been out for like 10 years now.
Right.
And
though
the game price point there is about $30. So it's still cheaper than a PC title, but it's not $2, which is where the market has kind of gone. I wonder why it is that the iPhone games can't pull. $10 seems expensive for an app, and I don't know why that is.
Yeah, $10 is a massive amount for a game. I mean, I know I've played more, I guess, Angry Birds and Fruit Ninja than almost any other game recently, and I don't think I would have paid $10 for those. And yet I'll drop $60 on Gears of War 3, right? Like, I don't know.
I guess, I mean, at some level, it's kind of a social engineering accomplishment of the iPhone guys, or maybe not an accomplishment, depending on how you look at it, of kind of setting that price point of 99 cents. And maybe a lot of that had to do with, you know, there was a lot of people who were kind of just trying to get onto the platform, right? When it first came out, I don't know if anyone really thought that this idea of, like, apps on a phone as a kind of a free market, kind of curated ecosystem would really work. And so maybe a lot of people just went in there and said, oh, well, I don't know. Well, I'll give it at a low price to see if anyone will buy this thing that I just invented in my garage. And it kind of stuck and continued to go. Like, you know, how did the big games decide that $60 was a good price for, say, Diablo 3?
Sure, I can tell you how.
It is. Yeah.
It's because programmers didn't set the price of those games. I think computer programmers undervalue their skill constantly. Right. And so they're like,
yeah,
oh, I did
really
this for fun. I had a lot of fun doing it. $2, $3.
Well, Apple set the $2, $3 price point for apps too, essentially because they were just trying to sell hardware.
Right.
When they originally started that market, you know, the App Store was not the goal. The App Store was just an avenue to get people to, you know, apps were not the goal. And since then, you know, what did Apple make last year from apps? Billions, you know, from
billions. Yeah,
sure.
But
iPhone alone.
No,
I
mean, it's an amazing accomplishment. Yeah. No, it's interesting. One thing I will say is, like, a lot of the games on the iPhone, Android are relative to, say, like a Game Boy. Game Boy games are still built kind of from beginning to end as a unit of gameplay. Like, you expect to have all the levels, all the story arc, all the kind of accomplishments, everything you can do in the game, and you kind of buy that as a package. It's interesting that, like, a lot of the iPhone content that comes out is it kind of comes out, like, Cut the Rope, for example, is a game I really enjoyed. You know, it comes out and they kind of release like two kind of boxes or rooms, then they release two more, and they have kind of these add-ons and stuff like that. So they kind of the way that games are kind of thought of is a little bit more of as a service that kind of gets added and incremented and changed, rather than as a complete package. That just still doesn't mean that it should be 99 cents versus $30, but there's a little bit in the mind of the people building those games, a slightly different mindset. Like, even for Ninja Boy, you know, we have two areas we've released. If we do successful enough to warrant continued investment, we plan to release four more areas plus kind of extra game content to kind of flesh out the entire arc of the story.
As in-app purchases?
Well, we're playing with different. I think we'll probably release the content, the core content, as just updates.
Okay.
And then we'll have in-app purchase type things. Like, we have ideas for kind of an arcade mode. We have ideas for kind of an infinite tower mode. We have different heroes that we have planned to release, different ninja suits and stuff. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. I think that's interesting that all of the updates have to be free. You can't charge for updates, right?
Well, you cannot charge for updates. There's a lot of, if you look through blogs and stuff, there's a lot of people, especially more in the productivity space, that do productivity software for, iPad. They're really bothered by the inability to pay for updates. But what you can do is you can use in-app purchases as a way to skirt that. So I could release Ninja Boy and I could have two more levels, but I could say, okay, when you click on the map icon that lets you go to the Misty Mountain or whatever it is, that's 99 cents. And so there's a way around it, but yes, you cannot have paid. The App Store doesn't support that. And some people like it, some people don't.
I've been really interested in the Temple Run story because those guys, started off as a 99 cent or, $1.99 app and got some success. I think they had something like 40,000 downloads or something as paid game. And when they switched to freemium with in-app purchases, it just blew up. Because it costs nothing to get involved, and then
Yeah, and the thing that's always been fascinating about that is that, well, Gabe Newell actually from Valve has a lot of they've been doing a lot of thinking about free to play, and they have different ways, like the way you phrase free to play versus free to try, or there's all these ways that psychologically you can get more people to try things out, with free to play. But at the end of the day, a lot of the games that are free and to play actually end up costing you a lot more. Because you spend all this money on upgrades and suits and power-ups or, whatever weapons or whatever. And so it's interesting. But I guess that's the thing, is if you can get people to try it, then maybe they're more willing to spend the extra money. At the end of the day, though, the marketplace is still highly saturated. And so there still is that aspect of, how do you get the word out? How do you let people know? So I think one of the biggest – we kind of knew this, but I think on our next game, that we do, we'll probably do a lot more upfront marketing. A lot more of kind of a dev diary, a lot more of a kind of coming soon kind of thing to try and build a buzz early. Because if you're doing indie games, it's gone are the days that you can just kind of release it on the iPhone and hope there's enough people that will find it and then spread the word. It really, you do have to kind of get the word out there, I think.
That's why you're doing our show. Thank you.
Exactly, yes. Exactly.
What was the hardest thing for you between playing games on the iPhone and then making one yourself?
I think when you make games, you get to a point where you lose almost all objectivity as to whether this game is still fun and challenging. Is it paced correctly? Because you stare at this thing. Like, I know how to solve every board. Like, extremely, I can do it easily. All the artwork starts to look kind of the same. It loses all of its wow factor.
Right.
That's probably the hardest thing is you design a puzzle, and it's, of course, the solution is easy for you. Is it going to be impossible for people? Is it going to be just challenging enough? I think the thing with Ninja Boy is I can still sit down and play it and have an enjoyable experience. And so to me, that says, okay, I did a good job creating this and pacing it and doing the gameplay. But overcoming that challenge of the mystery, kind of the curtain has been pulled up, and you know all the ins and outs of it, and so you stop enjoying games the same way. I've heard the same thing from guys who, do movies or study movies, film. It's hard for them to watch a film now because all they do is analyze.
Yeah, you obsess over individual frames.
Right. And how you would do things and how a shot's set up. And I tend to do that a lot with games, too, now. I try out tons of games, but I finish a far fewer games now because I'm really just analyzing games rather than actually playing them for enjoyment. So.
Hmm. Related to what we were talking about before with the psychology of things you can do to increase sales, how do you feel about things like developers using Skinner box techniques in order to – that's essentially what Farmville is, right?
Right.
Like using these psychological principles in order to either drive revenue and whatnot. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, on one level, bravo to those guys for coming up with that idea and leveraging it and figuring out a way from a business perspective, to make money. I think there's, they're smart and all that kind of things. I recently was having a conversation with a friend where I think some of those games almost need to be reclassified. Like they're almost not games in the traditional sense of a game. They're really not trying to accomplish the same things that classic game design is trying to
accomplish. It's more like a job, really.
It is, yeah. It's weird. Like there's analogies in the movie industry where you can be in kind of different genres of movies, and you definitely are kind of considered to be maybe not doing, you know, Hollywood movies. You're doing other types of movies and things like that. And movies have kind of matured to a point where they have these different classifications. Games are still kind of lumped in this one gigantic bucket of, like, everyone's building games where it's Farmville or whatever. You know, they're still doing games. And I'm not sure it's a good thing that it continues. I think maybe we do want to start educating people and start reclassifying games a little bit, because they are really trying to accomplish a very different thing. And in some ways, I'm not saying bringing down the kind of classic game design, but they do, I don't know, they do change it in certain ways.
Maybe, I really like that analogy. I do feel like Facebook games and in-app purchase type games are kind of like the B movie industry, right? It's like,
right.
They're going for a completely different consumer, a completely different kind of production process.
I was going to say, people can't even agree on whether or not games are art. And that is an unsolved question in movies, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think there are?
Yes. I think there are a lot of artistic components that make, you know, a game. I think they're definitely a form of art. I think a lot of games try to be movies. And I think a lot of games that are successful try to be movies. And I've never been as much of a fan of trying to make games into movies. I really like games that are much more about kind of mechanics and challenges and kind of the layering of those mechanics in order to create a kind of a classic game, a challenge that you feel gratification and satisfaction of overcoming. I'm not as big a fan of games that kind of show you the action rather than allowing you to participate in the action. And so I think, to be honest, games are still trying to figure out really how to tell great stories, you know, really how to, you know, fully immerse players, et cetera, et cetera. And it may never happen, but I think a lot of people are working on it, so.
Right. I definitely like the kind of the 8-bit nature of the game. I know it doesn't have 8-bit looking graphics,
right.
But at the same time, I can almost ballpark your age by going through the first, like, menus of the game, like the home screen with the little the little areas. I could just see, like, little dots connecting those and a little guy, like, walking along the dots.
Yeah, so that, you know, those are the games I grew up playing, right? Those are the games that I really enjoyed. And my brother and I's hope is that there are still those gamers out there, you know, that still want a game that, you know, you can move through, you have kind of this connection with the character. There is really a challenge to it, and we tried really to layer the challenge. Like, you can go through the board, and you can go through them pretty quickly, but if you want to get, you know, all the stars a little bit harder, if you want to get a Grandmaster ranking on the board, that's harder still, you know, so on and so forth. So...
Sorry, we're in New York City.
I totally understand. We hope that, you know, that aspect is there, that it's novel enough, you know, the authentically mobile thing and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
I think Nintendo's missing a huge opportunity with, like, they haven't released some of their games as, like, ports to iOS.
Yeah.
You know, releasing Super Mario 3 or, you know, some sort of, like, Super Mario All-Stars for iOS would be enormous for them. But I think they're still trying to figure out their own mobile gaming platforms as opposed to, you know, one of these days they're going to put a phone and a DS, and then they're a hardware company, as, you know, almost more than a game company themselves. So they're kind of trying to figure out where they are in that space.
Exactly. Nintendo's an interesting, you know, case study. The Wii was fantastic when it came out, at least. They haven't been able to maintain that momentum. Definitely Xbox and PlayStation have caught up. You know, will Nintendo go the route of a Sega, right, where Sega is really just a software company now and building titles? Nintendo has such amazing brands, things like Mario, Zelda, so on and so forth, that, you know, it could be very interesting for them. And they may be, in some degrees, more successful if they just made kind of the best mobile or software games for other platforms. So,
sort of like the Sega Genesis, they stopped making hardware and became a software company.
Yep.
Sure.
But Nintendo's games and their characters and those brands have been what has longevity, not their hardware. Even though I would say they would call themselves more a hardware company than a game company, it's been their games and those characters that have, you know, that I think will kind of stand the test of time. I think they would be more successful long term as a game company than
they were innovative in the control space, though, too.
That's
right. The Wiimote was the first one that did that. The Nintendo DS had all kinds of crazy inputs that I do think inspired the iPhone. Right?
Oh, like, no doubt. I mean, Nintendo is an amazingly innovative company. They just have, for whatever reason, have failed to kind of, like, the Wii, I think, was an amazing device. So I remember when I got it, you know, for one Christmas. I don't know if you've ever ridden on a Segway or, you know, done anything kind of like that, but it was an amazing kind of experience. Like, I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm actually interacting with a computer in this way.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they weren't able to kind of continue building those titles that you know, they never, you know, like, everyone wanted a Star Wars title that really rocked on the Wii and made it feel like you're, you know,
with
Skywalker
lightsaber
or something. They never were able to, with the lightsaber, they never were able to really realize that kind of a fidelity with their controls. And so as a result, they, you know, people have moved on to other platforms, or at least other platforms are more popular. So
Kinect felt the same way to me when I first when I first started using it, I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm, you know, I don't have a controller in my hand and this thing is just, you know, following my every move. And, but at the same time, I feel like the same few kind of tropes and skeuomorphisms sort of started to appear in every game and they all became the same game. And this happens with the iPhone too, right? You don't, you have a few of the same kind of control styles and tropes going on with games, and every so often somebody kind of breaks free of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, Carmack was talking about that a lot in his keynote. I think one of the things that plagues or challenges the success of a Wii or a Kinect is really that fidelity and that latency issue. You know, can you make it responsive enough to really feel like it's immersive rather than frustrating? And that's a hard thing to accomplish. I mean, the technology is still fairly immature, especially in the productized representation of it. So there's a fair way to go, I guess.
So yeah. There's a bunch of people probably listening to this or who will listen to this who are interested in becoming computer game programmers. And based on our age,
yes.
Options like DigiPen didn't exist when we were growing up and learning about programming. Would you recommend to somebody to going to DigiPen if they wanted to get into games? Or do you think it's one of those, you know, the technology is there, just go do it. Sort of like how filmmaking with flip cams and things, just go be a filmmaker.
Right. I think it depends on what kind of games you want to make. I think I've kind of learned in, you know, not my long career in software, but I've learned that there are people who really excel and enjoy working in kind of a corporate environment. And I think, you know, if you want to learn how to build big blockbuster games, maybe something like DigiPen would be great for you. If you're much more interested in kind of realizing your own ideas, you know, getting them out quickly, seeing if you kind of have the right stuff to make successful things, then I would say, you know, just figure out how to program, learn, connect with an artist or other, learn art yourself and start making your own creations. The Windows Phone games were the first games I released, but I built tons and tons of little games before I ever, you know, felt confident to release anything to the world. And so, you know, just experimenting, trying things out on your own is the route I've taken and I would recommend, you know, taking for anyone who wants to get into this.
I like that you said, learn art on your own. I don't know if this is a problem in the game industry. I would love for you to tell me. But in programming, we have this problem where we have idea guys. Like people who come and they want us to implement their idea because they've got some brilliant thing and they don't know how to code and they want you to do it for free. And I often tell them, well, why don't you learn to code, right? There's like one thing stopping you from realizing your dream, which is picking up essentially a foreign language.
Right.
Just learn it. Do you think, are there idea guys in games?
Yes, absolutely. And I've actually had many interesting email conversations with people.
I was just about to ask, how many emails have you gotten?
Who have told me, you know, if you just took my ideas, you'd be a millionaire. And they don't tell you their ideas, but, you know, they're trying to get some X amount of money from you and things like that. And I often will reply. I try to reply to everyone who emails me, but I often reply to those people that, you know, I'm sure your ideas are wonderful. I strongly encourage you to, you know, work on them on your own. I think I often will share that in my experience, an idea on paper or in your head is often very different than when you start realizing it in an actual, you know, interactive medium. Mm-hmm. And so maybe going through that process is worth doing to figure out if your idea really is good. When I learned programming, to me, it was like the most magical pencil kind of ever invented. It was this ability to take something in my head and translate it into a form that I could actually go and show to other people and they could start experiencing. I think there are a lot of people that just think of themselves as idea people. I think ideas are great, but I think being able to sit down and build things at some level of fidelity, it doesn't always have to be programming, I think is
just
essential.
Just a prototype or something.
Yeah, even if you do like a flipbook or something, I mean, that can be better than just kind of saying, I have this idea for, you know, a new something or other, a new first-person shooter.
Right.
But I do think there is really yet to be any replacement for a programmed interactive experience in all forms of software. I think that the tooling just isn't there yet in order to allow non-programmers to realize anything of consequence. And so, no, I think learning programming is one. It's hard, I guess, but it's I found incredibly gratifying. So I would encourage anyone interested in getting into games to learn programming, learn some degree of art. I think actually the 8-bit revolution allows a lot of people who don't have, say, art skills like my brother to still contribute to games. And if you focus on gameplay, you can actually still build, you know, fairly successful games. Doodle Jump doesn't have the best art in the world, but it's a very interesting idea with a very novel mechanic, and it's highly addictive, and it's been very successful.
That was something else Carmack was talking about. Like, we've hit our limit for for you know what consumers right. want in terms of fidelity and quality of game. I mean, we'll still try, you know, strive for photorealism, but that doesn't
right.
You know,
right. Preclude. We'll strive for photorealism as a technical challenge because that's right. who we are and that's what we do. But it doesn't. Right.
But people still love 8-bit style games.
Yeah, I actually like your logo a lot, Steven.
I do too. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Where'd you call it? Why 2-ton?
Well, so my last name is Danton, and so it's 2 Dantons, so 2 tons.
Oh,
nice.
2-ton studio, so yeah. So I actually learned this way after naming the studio, but my father and his brother used to play baseball, and they used to be their nickname was 2-ton as well. So that's kind of a
nice.
An interesting kind of, I don't know, piece of insight from my own family yeah. history. Yeah, yeah. Nice. So, yeah, on the Carmack point about the visualization, I think he's very right. I think the challenges now are can you make kind of the kinetics of movement, and can you build environments that are real and kind of you know adaptable and destructible and all those kind of things, and can you start really simulating things at a high enough fidelity? And those seem to be some of the next wave of challenges, you know for the highest ends of game yeah. game development.
Or creating a game that looks so much like a cartoon that it feels like you're playing a cartoon. Even that is,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Custom shaders and things like that.
Right. Do you storytelling, think? I think, is also kind of this frontier. Chris Taylor from used to work on Gaspar Games. They did a lot of RTSs. I think spent like 5 years trying to build truly dynamic stories. Stories that you know, in the kind of utopic sense, you could have the ethos of Star Wars, all of the characters, but you can kind of play it from any character's perspective, and you could even change the story. You know, so that you know. What Luke does something different, or you know, Vader actually goes and turns into the next emperor or whatever, and so that's another big area that I actually spend a fair amount of time thinking about, but also that I think you know games will have to fill into to really become that kind of next storytelling medium beyond. Like I still personally will often enjoy reading a book more than I will enjoying the story of a particular game, but I think software has the potential to actually push beyond that and to really be this fantastic medium for communicating stories.
I wonder if virtual reality will help. Carmack spent a lot of time talking about VR and this immersive yeah. experience into really putting you in the story so that you feel like you are in the world and having a completely immersive experience. Maybe not. He seems to think that that's the next thing.
I think it's definitely part of a piece of the puzzle, so to speak. There's a Japanese game designer, I can't remember his name, but you know, he talks about actually smell, like smell vision kind of thing as being an equally important aspect of kind of immersing people into the experience so that not only what you see visually and hear, you know, is also augmented by smell. I think one of the challenges with VR is how do you, you know, like let's say if we VR-ified Ninja Boy, you know, how sure. would we do that? Like how would we jump and move and you know, Ninja Boy is right. a fairly mechanically simple game. What if you tried to VR like Ninja Gaiden or something? Which, you know, you have, so how do you VR, like, wall runs and, like, backflips and fighting right. a tank? And so those are really interesting challenges Valve is definitely working on. Actually, Gabe Newell had some interesting comments on, you know, controlling things with your tongue because your eyes are inherently fickle. When he made that statement that Windows 8 is a catastrophe, one of those things that, you know, got lost in that was their work on the augmented reality and VR stuff. But how do you allow, you know, the average human to actually do extraordinary beyond kind of Olympic gymnast type feats
right
and still feel immersed in the
yeah,
game
how do you do a backflip on the Kinect
like, right yeah
if you know, can't and, do it in
yeah,
real
if
life
you're just right if you're just doing that with your eyes or your tongue that's definitely not going to feel as gratifying as there's this interesting level of indirection that games provide and the controller kind of allows you to kind of put yourself in that space and you don't feel physically limited but if you actually are trying to be in that physical space and you can't, you know, kick over your head or jump more than 30 inches, you know, it might come crashing down on you a little bit. So I think those would be interesting challenges to solve. The definitely smart guys work on it.
The thing with the controller is interesting because, like, we're tool users, human beings.
Yes.
And to us, the tool, like, all of our tools become extensions of our bodies, right? If you had to think about every motion you do when you drive down the street, you wouldn't be able to drive. But instead,
exactly,
the car becomes part of who you are as you're driving down. And you just use it. The controller's that way, too. It becomes invisible to the action that you're trying to do.
Right. But the controller also kind of becomes a replacement for a lot of the things you do. It's not an extension of you. It's an extension of your mind, not an extension of your body.
Your body's just an extension of your mind. We're in the Matrix, Neo. The backflips. There was a funny Penny Arcade about when the Kinect came out, about basically how video game nerds were going to become the new jocks and start beating up jocks because of the physical movements they had to do in order to play the games would make them super buff.
They'd be so incredibly fit.
Right, they become gymnasts, essentially, to do backflips.
Exactly.
I'm excited to see the first big fighting game that comes out of VR. We've had shooting games and maybe even like sword fighting games. I know that we had some interesting sword fighting games, but the first VR fighting game to really click is going to be some.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it could be really interesting. Yeah. And maybe it will be athletes that first do these things. Like maybe the guy who is actually quite athletic will be they'll be the test people, and they'll slowly figure out how to make it so mere mortals can kind of. Still enjoy that kind of experience.
Let's be honest, it's going to be porn.
yeah, probably.
That's where the money is.
Absolutely.
Those are all the questions that I had.
Yeah, it's been awesome. I'm super excited about doing a gaming show, and thanks a lot.
Cool, thanks guys. It's been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking the time. It's very hard to get the word out as an indie dev, so I appreciate it.
Sure.
It's been really great.
And let us know when you're ready to start talking about your next title.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We already started concepting on that. Nice. It's probably going to be a sci-fi based game.
Oh.
We're playing with a bunch of different ideas on. We're big fans of XCOM, so we're thinking of taking.
I was just about to say XCOM.
XCOM aspects, a little bit of kind of a hybrid of like squad based tower defense is kind of in the mix right now. So we have some interesting ideas, we think, and we're really trying to figure out, do we want to. Like, how high-end do we want to go? Like, Ninja Boy, we kind of tried to make a more of a casual, broad audience kind of experience. Do we want to go a little more niche, for people that might remember something like XCOM? So we're just playing with those ideas. But definitely I'll let you guys know. I'd love it if you guys would be, interested in talking about it.
Tower defense games are my heroine. I don't know how. I
just started playing Dungeon Defenders, and sure enough.
Yeah, they're pretty. I think they work very well on an iPad, and an iPhone. So trying to take the theme of that and twist it a little bit, because it is fairly saturated right now, the tower defense market. So that's going to be a challenge.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks, Stephen.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks so much, guys. Take it easy.
Yep.
Bye.